Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Legend has it that if you go to Park Avenue and 17th Street very early in the morning and listen very closely, you can still hear the echoes of this Velvet Underground performance at the old Max's Kansas City. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the program, a visit from the ghosts of nightlife past. And later, an update on The Odyssey by Homer. We'll hear a preview of a new adaptation by composer Sarah Kirkland Snyder. But we begin a new series today called Vanished Venues. All this week, Soundcheck will look back at legendary hotspots in New York music history, and today, a doubleheader. We'll talk about the Greenwich Village Club, The Bottom Line, in just a bit, but we'll begin with Max's Kansas City, a haven for musicians and artists on Park Avenue South that opened in 1964, or 65, rather. It's the subject of a new photo book called Max's Kansas City, Art, Glamour, Rock and Roll. It was edited by gallery owner Stephen Kasher, and he joins me in our Soundcheck studio. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So it was opened in 1965 by Mickey Ruskin, and it was really an artist's haven first off, wasn't it?
That was Mickey's goal, to make a place where he and his artist friends would be happy and thriving, meeting people and hanging out, and it was an immense success from the first go.
So how did it become a place for visual artists? How did it go from being a place for visual artists to being such a central place for music?
Well, it started with this crew of visual artists: John Chamberlain, Frosty Myers, Larry Zox, Larry Poons, Frank Stella, a few others. They were really these very muscular, very macho, hard-drinking guys making giant paintings, giant sculpture, and it just became the place for everybody who was cool and hip to hang out. So within a couple of years, you have, I mean, there's a great picture in the book in the show by Elliot Landy. It shows Janis Joplin, Andy Warhol, Tim Buckley, and Paul Morrissey sitting on one of the tables in the back room. That was the night that the Fillmore East opened, the very first night. The opening act was Janis and Big Brother, opened by Tim Buckley. Where did they go after the show, this great, you know, historic show? They went to Max's.
Now, Max's, Park Avenue South, 17th Street, this was nowhere back in 1965. It was way off the beaten track of where music normally happened in Manhattan.
Yeah, well,
they say you fish where the fish are, but you know, Ruskin wasn't fishing where the fish were.
Well, Danny Fields has this funny line: if you dropped a bomb there, probably nobody would be hurt, you know, at night. There was nothing there at night. There were offices and during the day. That's right. It was cheap. It was available. It had been a Southern restaurant. Mickey wanted a new place, and he thought he could make a go there. Some of the artists had their studios there, so that was the other connection.
Now, the artists were nearby with their studios, and so you eventually have, you know, musicians who are playing at bigger venues like the Fillmore East dropping by afterwards for what we would now call the after party. At what point does Max's Kansas City sort of ramp up as a presenting musical venue on its own?
Well, before that, you have a discotheque, a informal, after-hours, off-the-record place where they're spinning records, a lot of Motown, and people are drifting up from the bar restaurant, which is downstairs, to this empty room upstairs. It was used as a storeroom. And Lee Black Childers was spinning records, and it became a famous dance party.
Mm-hmm.
Around 1970, somebody was inspired to make it into a music venue, and the Velvet Underground spent a whole summer there, and it was their final concert. So that really kicks it off, 1970.
And over the next series of years, it would become, I mean, it was a very diverse group of people. Was this Mickey Ruskin's doing? I mean, did he book the club himself, or did he have people telling him, you know, hey, this guy Lou Reed, you know, his band, Velvet Underground. They're really, you should have them in.
Well, Mickey's taste in music, as I understand it, went towards country, Motown, and generally the hits of the 60s. So the jukebox, which was also much appreciated, was going downstairs. No, Mickey did not bring the axe in upstairs. It was a couple of other people. He was not responsible for that. But he wanted these kind of things going on, and he realized that his bar had to keep evolving. I mean, Max's was the cool, hip, important party in New York for about 8 years, from until 73 when Mickey sold it.
We're speaking with Stephen Kasher, who's the editor of Max's Kansas City, Art, Glamour, Rock and Roll, and Illustrated History of Max's Kansas City, which closed for the first time in 1974. But by the time that had happened, there had been an amazing array of musicians performing on that stage at Max's, including Iggy Pop and the Stooges.
Walking cheetah with a hat full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of the nuclear A-bomb. I am a world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. Somebody gotta help me, please. Somebody gotta save my soul.
And on the same stage where Iggy and the Stooges played, a very young Bruce Springsteen made an appearance at Max's Kansas City. Bruce Springsteen also appearing on stage at Max's Kansas City in 1973. All of these artists in the same year, the same place, the Stooges, Springsteen, and the disco soul star, Sylvester. Yes, that is Neil Young's Southern Man, a cover by Sylvester and the Hot Band. So 1973, a big year for Max's Kansas City. We're speaking with Stephen Kasher, owner of the Stephen Kasher Gallery, which is where the exhibition of photos from this book, Max's Kansas City, was up and running until recently. And Soundcheck listeners, this is the opening salvo in our week-long series we're calling Vanishing Venues. And not that they're vanishing. They're vanished. They're gone. The Max's Kansas City closed in 1981. But maybe you were there. And if you were, we want to hear from you. We'll be talking about the bottom line in a couple of minutes. If you were at either of those places, we'd like you to share your story and keep it clean. It is a family show. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Or leave a comment on the Soundcheck webpage, which is wnyc.org/soundcheck. So, Stephen, we mentioned 73, a big year, 74, an even bigger year in the extent to the extent that it was the last year that Mickey Ruskin kept the club open. What happened?
Well, Mickey moved on. He opened some other places, one university and the Ocean Club downtown, further downtown. The club was taken over by Tommy Dean, and it became the rival to CBGB's. Punk bands were playing every night.
So if up to 74 was, you know, Max's Kansas City Mach 1, Mark II was this punk club, and it really did become a kind of rival scene. I mean, I know there were bands that played both places, but as a, you know, patron, very fancy word for people who went to CB's or to Max's, you usually went to one or the other. I would go to CBGB's simply because I couldn't afford Max's. And that was the other thing. You had to have money, real money, to go to Max's Kansas City.
I hear you. Your next club, the Bottom Line. I actually know more about in that period because I was a bartender there from the first year it was open.
Well, now, speaking of bartending, I mean, Andy Warhol's bar tab from Max's Kansas City.
Well, that's an important story. What galvanized the first part of Max's was the tabs given to these artists I mentioned, and they weren't even really paid those tabs. So you'd have Chamberlain and Frosty and these other people running up the tabs, Warhol too. Mickey would let them just slide, and that became their home away from home. And it was, these artists were so important and so admired. They really were a core of something new going on. And the story of Max's is really the story of this revolution that's happening in art and politics, visual, music, all at the same time. It really is a great 60s story about the road of excess leading to the Palace of Wisdom, if you will, Blake's famous aphorism. Mm. I mean, I think Max's represents that in New York better than any other place.
And so this great story of the 60s survives halfway through the 70s in one form and then in a very different form gets through the rest of the 70s. What happens in 1981 that puts a period at the end of the sentence?
I think that music had sort of run its course, and that size of a club for this kind of music, it just isn't working anymore.
Well, I mean, CB's, of course, continued on for decades after that, playing essentially the same music, although I suppose you could say the music had run its course and they just didn't know it. We've got a number of calls and comments. Danny joining us on the line from New York. Danny, do you have a memory of Max's Kansas City?
Hi. Yeah, I used to play there a lot with several different bands. But this memory is something that happened at the Lower Manhattan Ocean Club, which Mickey also owned. I accidentally burned Mick Ronson, David Bowie's guitar player, with a cigarette. And then I got to apologize to him a couple of days later at Max's Kansas City.
So Bowie and Ronson were hanging out at Max's.
No, Ronson was Ronson was there with Lou Reed and Mark Hale at the Manhattan Ocean Club, and then he was with I think Ian Hunter at Max's a few nights later.
Bowie also made pretty famously an appearance on stage at Max's Kansas City, introducing Devo back in something like 1977, introducing them as like the band of the future or something like that. So it sounds, Stephen, like this, you know, this...
This is a good example of some of the early things that would happen at Max's. So Bowie came in from London, came to Max's, met Johansson of the New York Dolls and Lou Reed in Max's, and really took on a new persona based on having met these New York innovators who were really ahead of the curve where Bowie was starting to enter.
Steve on the line with us from Rockland County. Steve, you have a memory of Max's?
I have the best music memory of my life from Max's Kansas City. I was there once with two of my buddies who dragged me from New Jersey, say, we got to go to Max. There's this new band from Jersey playing in New York City named Bruce Springsteen. Never heard of the guy. Went there. Who opens for him are these two other guys, Hall & Oates. I'm blown away by them. Say, Bruce can't be any better than these guys. And, of course, Bruce blew the top off the place. It was the best show I ever went to. Unfortunately, two of the guys I went with are no longer with us. They died. I can never talk about the show because nobody believes me.
What year was this, Steve?
You guys, whoever put that together, it's a memory that will be with me forever, and just absolutely incredible.
Do you remember the year? Would this have been 73?
It had to be around between 73 and 70. Yeah, probably 73, 74.
All right.
Well, in the book, we commemorate a concert where it was Springsteen's first concert at Max's. It was 73. And the opening act was the Wailers. Bob Marley hadn't even made it on his name onto the top of the Wailers. And there was a wonderful, wonderful review that we published in the book. Voice by Lorraine O'Grady. It never ran. It's incredibly prescient. She loves Springsteen. She loves the Wailers. They didn't even publish it. It didn't seem important enough.
Right. Well, who's ever going to hear of these people down the road?
Exactly.
Um, Steven, how do we have this book when Mickey Ruskin was notorious for not allowing photography? How do we have a whole book of photographs from Max's Kansas City?
Well, first of all, because of Anton Perich, who entered Max's having come from Paris, where he worked with the Situationists in May of 68 during the uprising there. And he comes to New York and he gets a job. He hears about Max's, gets a job there as a busboy. He is the worst busboy ever, but he's a terrific photographer and videographer. And Mickey, who loves Anton, lets him take pictures, which he never let anybody else did because he wanted to respect the privacy of amazing people who were coming there. So most of the pictures of the early restaurant, bar, artist, music scene are by Anton Perich.
Okay.
And then later on you have lots of photographers shooting the music.
Here's a comment from Pam in upstate New York. I was there when Patti Smith and Phil Oakes were on. There's an odd pairing. Phil was overweight in a gold lamé jumpsuit. He couldn't perform well because supposedly someone tried to strangle him in South Africa. Of course, not long after that, he hung himself. It might have been his last appearance. Wow.
Wow, I haven't heard that story. So many amazing Max's stories come up.
And is that the legacy of Max's Kansas City? These old stories of people who would then later become famous getting their start on this relatively little stage in a desolate part of Lower Manhattan?
Well, I think the legacy is where people with no money but incredible creativity came together and shared everything that was new and built each other up, respected each other, influenced each other, came to work together. You have crazy combinations like John Chamberlain and Taylor Mead making a movie together, having met at Max's. You have something called the Moon Museum that was put together at Max's by Frosty Myers and a bunch of artists, and it's actually the only artwork that is on the moon right now.
Hmm.
Was sent up from Max's.
From Max's. All right, that's a great little legacy from this little club. A vanished part of New York's music scene. We've been speaking with Stephen Kasher, owner of the Stephen Kasher Gallery and editor of the illustrated book Max's Kansas City, Art, Glamour, Rock and Roll. Tons of photos and contributions by Lou Reed and Lenny Kaye and many others. Stephen, a real pleasure having you on Soundcheck today.
Thank you very much.
Up next, our series on vanished venues continues, and we'll hear how intimate performances from acts like, again, Bruce Springsteen, Dolly Parton, and The Police made The Bottom Line a destination for music lovers. New York Dolls, they were famous for their performances at Max's Kansas City. Coming up in a little while, rock songstress Shara Warden and the Y Music Ensemble will perform a genre-defying song cycle called Penelope by Sarah Kirkland Snyder live in our studio. And tomorrow on Vanished Venues, we'll hear about Danceteria, the New York dance club that brought together acts as diverse as Philip Glass, Devo, and a rising star named Madonna. Did you move to the music at Danceteria? Leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at wnyc.org/soundcheck.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
When Michael Hedges first played The Bottom Line and got everybody in the audience to sing the Beatles' Come Together at the end, there was something magical about that moment, a sense of people making their own music, oblivious to the hurly-burly of the New York streets and what I believe was some seriously rainy weather just outside. And it wasn't just Hedges, it was Hedges in that place that made the moment so special.
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at wnyc.org.